So very close friends, opponents who are still friends, and colleagues would be the three broad categories of this book.
Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of the website EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, and today Dr. Joel Heck is back on the program. Joel has done a lot of interesting C.S. Lewis-related things, and he returns to talk about a new book entitled No Ordinary People. It came out in late 2021. It explores 21 friendships of C.S. Lewis. Well, welcome back to All About Jack, Joel.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here once more.
Well, now, let's see. It's been said that you get to know a person by knowing about the people he or she was friends with. As your book focuses on individuals who Lewis considered friends, maybe a good way to begin is to ask if all of these friendships were alike, along with how many you cover.
Well, most of our listeners will be familiar with the four loves and the fact that Lewis talked about side-by-side friends, people that he was really, really close to. That's one of the largest section, really, people who are very, very close friends. But there are also two other sections, a group a little bit smaller than that, who are actually on opposite sides of various theological points, some Christians, some not, but they were still friends. Lewis still related cordially to them. So that's the second section. The third section is what I'd call colleagues. The book is that section is entitled Co-workers and Fellow Pilgrims, but basically colleagues, people that he taught with at the same university, Oxford University, Cambridge University, or people that he worked with in the Oxford Socratic Club. So very close friends, opponents who are still friends, and colleagues would be the three broad categories of this book.
Well, then now let's have you pick a couple of the side-by-side, the first group of friends, to briefly share about. Tell how many you have in this section, then maybe just highlight two or three and give a summary of them.
Well, there are nine people in the first group, the side-by-side friends, very close friends. And I guess I'd pick Janie Moore, who was known as Mrs. Moore or Dee in Lewis's diaries and letters. What the surrogate mother that he kind of adopted when her son, Patty Moore, died in World War I, and then Arthur C. Clarke. So I guess I picked Janie Moore partly because there's been this controversy, even among Lewis fans, about whether there was something intimate between Lewis and Janie Moore or not. And I really address that in this chapter. But it all goes back to the promise that Lewis and Patty Moore made when they were roommates at the Officers Training Corps there at Oxford University, training to enter the Allies' forces against Nazi Germany on the continent. And so the two boys promised that if one of them survived and the other one did not, that the survivor would take care of the other one's parent. So Jack's father was alive. His mother had died. Patty's mother was alive and well, and divorced, so really alienated from her husband. So they entered into this relationship, and it was a very unusual relationship. I talk about some of the pluses as well as the minuses of Mrs. Moore, because most of the time when Janie Moore is mentioned, it's a negative kind of a thing, especially Warren Lewis writes in his diary, he says, "I have lived most of my private life in a house which was hardly ever at peace for 24 hours amid senseless wranglings, lyings, backbitings, follies, and scares. I never went home without a feeling of terror as to what appalling situation might have developed in my absence. Only now that it is over," and he writes this shortly after her death, "do I begin to realize quite how bad it was." Well, Mrs. Moore did have a lot of strengths. I mean, she was generous. She was very hospitable. She was very concerned about advancing the career of Jack Lewis. She was a good manager of the household, a good cook, very kind, especially to those people who were in need. So she had some really great strengths, especially earlier in life. But she also was a bit of a difficult woman to relate to, and one sort of understands why her husband ended up divorcing her. Oddly enough, I don't know if this is odd or not, actually, but both Janie Moore and her husband were PKs, preacher's kids. And so you would sort of think that two children of pastors would have the kind of spiritual resources to be able to get along with one another, but apparently they did not. And so I end up dealing with the issue of whether there was a sexual intimacy between them before Lewis's conversion, and conclude that there's an awful lot of evidence that there was, but that he cut off that aspect of their relationship after his conversion to Christianity in 1931. So the other person that I would mention in Robert E. Havard, the Lewis family physician. Havard was, Havard, I guess, is one way that they pronounce it in England. I just pronounce it Havard. It's kind of the way it seems to read. He was the family physician after the Lewis family doctor died in the early to mid-1930s. We're not quite certain the exact date and when the two men met, but it was 1933-1934 when Robert Emlyn Havard came to the house and dealt with, I guess it was some flu that Jack was having, and they hit it off. They talked more about philosophy than they did about medicine and health. They became good friends. Havard became a regular member of the Inklings, joined Lewis on some walking tours and some trips. So he was a companion of his, a very sharp mind who had read widely. And one of the interesting things about Havard, his nickname was Humphrey. And I talk about how he got that nickname in that chapter. But in the book Perelandra, the second book in the Ransom trilogy, the physician who would attend Ransom upon his return from the planet Perelandra, which of course we know as Venus, was named Humphrey. And that's the nickname that the Inklings assigned to Dr. Havard. So that's those are a couple of the people that are in this category of close friends.
Okay, good. And of course, you have, I think you said it was 9 that are in that section. But anyway, the second section of your book, which again is called No Ordinary People, explores the 5 opponents you say would still be considered friends of Lewis. Since there are only 5, you don't have to do it this way, but I thought maybe give just a little bit of snippet about each of them.
Okay. Well, Arthur C. Clarke, probably the most well-known individual among these 21 friends that Lewis had, author of more than 100 books on science, science fiction, and space travel. He's also called the father of communication satellites because he is the first person ever to predict communication satellites. He did that in an article he wrote, was published in 1945, so about 20 years before this actually came to fruition. And in his honor, I don't know what group did this, but there is an orbit above the equator in space that orbits around the Earth that is named after him, the Arthur Clarke orbit. He was chairman of the British Interplanetary Society, called Prophet of the Space Age. Some would say, with Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, one of the big 3 writers in science fiction. And he actually appeared on television on CBS with Walter Cronkite, Eric Severide, and former astronaut Wally Schirra when Apollo 11 landed on the moon in 1969. So a fascinating character in his own right, Arthur C. Clarke. Harry Weldon, T.D. Weldon, Thomas Dewar Weldon, but he got the nickname Harry. This is the guy who is known from Lewis's autobiography, Surprised by Joy, as the guy who made the rum thing comment, what I like to call the rum thing comment. Weldon, in the early days, when they were friends rather than opponents, both of them taught philosophy, but Weldon was a professional philosopher. And Weldon made a comment in 1926. He says, rum thing, it almost looks as if it had happened once. And he's talking about the resurrection. And he's probably talking about the record in the gospel, especially the Gospel of John, to the resurrection of Jesus. And he's arguing that the evidence for the resurrection is surprisingly strong. And this shocked Lewis because Lewis was a card-carrying atheist at this time. He thought Weldon was, although I challenged that in the chapter in the book, but it shook him so much that he went back to the scriptures and reread those accounts of the passion narratives, including the resurrection, and it caused him to begin rethinking. And he said of Weldon, if even he isn't safe, well then where am I? I mean, my faith in atheism and the lack of a deity in this universe is being shaken by this offhanded comment by Harry Weldon. A third one in that group is C.E.M. Jode, a guy who grew up in the Church of England, but at Oxford University as a student, he became an agnostic and a socialist. He left the church. He later returned to the Church of England, especially a very, very colorful person, a philosopher actually as a profession, who wrote many books attempting to popularize philosophy and did a pretty good job of it. Also had a huge ego and was known as a philanderer and a scallywag, and ended up on BBC Radio as part of a program called The Brains Trust, where listeners would send in questions and then a moderator would call on three or four people who were there to answer the questions. And Jode was always very colorful. Jode also spoke at one of the largest meetings of the Oxford Union when they debated, I believe it was 1933, whether or not Oxford University students would fight in a war against Germany as the clouds of war were gradually darkening over Europe. So eventually he saw evil in Nazi Germany, and he saw it in his own heart when he got caught trying to, he said, I cheat the railways whenever I can. He got caught on a train after having boasted in public that he did this. He got caught on a train without a ticket, and he got kicked off from the BBC Brains Trust program. And eventually came to realize that not only is evil out there, but it's also in here in my own heart. And he began a journey back to the Christian faith in the early 50s, just a few years before his death, partly because of the influence of the writings of Lewis. He knew Lewis. He read some of Lewis's books, including The Abolition of Man. And he came back to the church, became a Christian once again, just a couple of years before he died. And he wrote a book called The Recovery of Belief that tells a lot of that story. The fourth one is Alec Vidler, an Anglican clergyman of the liberal variety, who became, I think it was the fourth editor of Theology, which was a monthly periodical that Lewis contributed to, about 8 or 10 pieces, some book reviews. And it's the place, I think its greatest distinction in reality is that it's the place where C.S. Lewis's famous sermon from 1941, The Weight of Glory, was published. And in fact, it's that sermon, now an essay, where Lewis makes the comment, there are no ordinary people. And that comment is what serves as the title for this book. So it's subtitled 21 Friendships of C.S. Lewis. But there are no ordinary people. And as we read about these different friendships of Lewis, we discover even people that we might at a distance or at a quick glance think are kind of ordinary, like Lewis's lifelong friend, Arthur Greaves. We look more closely at their lives and we find, no, he really wasn't ordinary. And that gives a lot of comfort and encouragement to each of us, because none of us are ordinary either. Every person is a child of God, made in the image of God. The fifth and last one is J.B.S. Haldane, an atheist known as having been the model for Weston in the Ransom trilogy. The bad guy scientist who figured out how to do space travel to Malacandra and then Paralandra. I was an atheist. He's the author of Haldane's Dilemma, because even though he was an evolutionist, he was aware that evolution presents a huge mathematical problem, and that is that the amount of time it takes for any particular mutation, if neutral or beneficial, to be permeated throughout a population is something like 300 generations. And the length of time that it takes for those mutations to permeate a population of some living creature is so long that Haldane said, we really got a problem with the length of time that we're saying that the universe has been in existence, even if we're suggesting billions and billions of years. So that's a quick synopsis of those five friendships of Lewis.
And yes, these are all very fascinating. I remember years ago, before you had a publisher and such, I think it was the chapter on C.E.M. Jode that I read, and it was very fascinating. And I know later I officially asked you about the response about people that have read the book, either it was an endorsement or a review on Amazon. But one of the things that does stand out in my mind that I know someone else had said was, you know, being familiar with Lewis, they didn't realize how interesting some of these other individuals that Lewis knew or were friends with, how fascinating that they were. And so what you've pulled together here is, you know, many biographies of friends of Lewis that I think people who have maybe read most of everything about Lewis, and they think, oh, another book related to C.S. Lewis, there's so many. So this would be definitely of interest to them, but also people who enjoy biographies about individuals, even though this doesn't dive into Lewis directly, it dives into all the individuals. And so it can be fascinating to those already very well read in Lewis studies, but also those maybe not necessarily interested in Lewis studies, but in biographies, and then the friendship factor that you talk about, and you spend the, I guess it's the introduction before you go into the first individual. So it's a very good book, and we're going to talk about the third section in a moment, but let's pause before going on and give you a minute to provide the listener with who the heck is Joel Heck. Maybe there's some people that haven't heard about you before, especially those who are learning about you for the first time. Give a summary of who you are, Joel.
Yeah, well, for anybody interested in some of the mundane details, there is a Wikipedia article on me that they can go to, a sort of side view of me. And my work on Lewis is available at www.joelheck.com. I am the husband of one wife and the father of three children and the grandfather of three grandkids. I live in Austin, Texas. I think I'm probably in Lewis circles best known for a document that's on my website called Chronologically Lewis that documents year by year, month by month, day by day, sometimes even multiple events within a day, what was happening in the lives of C.S. Lewis and his brother Warren. So anybody that wants to know when certain things happened and make sure they get things in the right order, they can check out that file. They can actually download it for free. I think that charging a fee actually limits scholarship and limits availability of knowledge. And so I make it available as a Word document that people can search as much as they like. My website also has a lot of downloadable PowerPoints. My PowerPoint on Little Lee, the childhood home of C.S. Lewis, has been described by a friend of mine as the best place to go in order to see the house, and even some photographs that I took through the windows of Little Lee, what that house was, a little bit what it was like. That house got so many visitors that the owners eventually put a fence around the property, so you can't get close to the house anymore. And I was able to get there before that fence was put up. So I have a doctorate in biblical studies, especially Old Testament, but also New Testament. I've written 15 books, several of them on Lewis, and dozens of articles. Started working with Lewis more extensively when I taught a course on Lewis in London, England in 1995, and I've been going strong ever since. And that's probably enough on me for the time being, at least.
Right, sure. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, we'll ask another question in a moment to tease out some additional information about yourself. But yeah, so section 3 in your book examines 7 co-workers and fellow pilgrims, as you call them. And give us a taste maybe of 2 or 3 of them from this part of your book.
Okay. Let's select about Derek Brewer as one of the individuals. This isn't all that well known. This is one of the last chapters that I wrote. I had some time. I decided to add 3 more chapters. This Derek Brewer is a former student of Lewis, later professor of English at the University of Birmingham. He was a Chaucer scholar. He and a colleague invited C.S. Lewis to be the general editor of something that I bet at least half of your listening audience has never even heard of. And maybe you haven't even, William, I don't know. but he became general editor for a series of medieval writings that were reissued with annotations called Nelson's Medieval and Renaissance Library.
I did not.
So this is in the late 50s, early 60s. Derek Brewer became the master of Emmanuel College at Cambridge University. He wrote a chapter about Lewis in C.S. Lewis at the Breakfast Table that most of us are familiar with. And so some little known, I think one by Chaucer and other documents, medieval documents that were part of the English curriculum at Oxford and Cambridge University. So that would be one of the two people. The other one I guess I would pick would be Maureen Moore, who later on became Lady Dunbar of Hempriggs. She was the daughter of Janie Moore and therefore sister of Patty Moore, who died in the war, lived in the same house with C.S. Lewis for decades. And Lewis made a comment once that she had a well-stocked library of fairy tales. Well, she liked fairy tales, and of course, Lewis wrote some. During the last year of his life, Lewis had a heart attack and went into a coma in the summertime. Maureen Moore, earlier that year, had been named the 8th Baronetess Dunbar of Hempriggs, which is a small estate in northern Scotland. She came to visit him in the hospital. She had not seen him since she had been named Lady Dunbar earlier that year. Others had come to see Lewis earlier that day, but he hadn't recognized them. She came into his hospital room and said, "Jack, it is Maureen." And with his eyes closed, he said, "No, it's Lady Dunbar of Hempriggs." "Oh, Jack," she said, "how could you remember that?" "On the contrary," he replied, "how could I forget a fairy tale?" So a very cool story about a woman that knew Lewis almost as well as anybody did, and certainly knew him from a different perspective than most of the other people in this book. I mean, she knew him well for a long time. Probably only Warren Lewis, Jack's brother, and Arthur Greaves knew Lewis as well as Maureen Moore did. At any rate, Derek Brewer and Maureen Moore, one male, one female.
Okay. Yeah, good. Well, now, yeah, I was going back through recalling who all you addressed now. Of course, I guess I'll make a quick side note. Obviously, there are some more famous or well-known individuals that would be considered friends of Lewis that you don't deal with by virtue of there's so much other stuff out there. Someone that wrote something, I think there's going to be a series on Amazon, something with rings. It has a ring to it.
That's an obscure name.
J.R.R. something. The last name escapes me. But anyway, but speaking of more seriously, a famous or a relative thereof, I'd almost forgotten that you include Mary Shelley, who you note is distantly related to the author of Frankenstein. So people will have to pick up your book to find out more about that, as well as some other individuals. Most people who have studied Lewis are aware of the Oxford Socratic Club. And so you have a chapter here that in this section dealing with her, Stella Altwinkle, if I'm saying that correctly. And so a lot of good things. In fact, speaking of the Oxford Socratic Club, that dovetails into the next question to get some more biographical things about you. You already were noted about your website, but in terms of Lewis, things that you've done or you helped see to light, go ahead and share about your other writings, and I will put a link in the show notes to those podcast interviews where we talk about them.
Well, one thing that I wasn't even thinking of before we started this conversation is a project that you and I collaborated on a few years ago. Remember when we took all of the available photographs of C.S. Lewis, some of them dated, some of them not, and tried to put them into chronological order for the benefit of the Wade Center, as well as other people wanting to know, okay, when is this photo from and when is that photo from? So that was a project. We took dozens of photographs and tried to figure out where we didn't know exactly the date that this photograph was taken, where would we place it based upon how much hair Lewis had and how much weight he had, and just did he look older than this one than in that one. So we figured out a few things.
Yeah,
there's still some things that aren't totally certain, but that's one project that we did. I've written 5 books on C.S. Lewis, 15 books overall, but Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education was the first one. From Atheism to Christianity came out in 2017, is an in-depth study of and relating of the biographical information that led up to Lewis's conversion and all the minor steps in between his reading of George MacDonald's Fantasties in 1916 and his conversion to Christianity in September of 1931. This book is the third book that I wrote from scratch, No Ordinary People, 21 Friendships of C.S. Lewis, just came out last October. And I also have 2 edited books. So I was able to get permission from the Lewis Company to reissue a version of The Personal Heresy, a fairly obscure book of debate, a debate between E.M.W. Tilliard, a Cambridge English professor, and Lewis. So they debated whether or not a piece of writing, a poem or a creative piece of writing, is more a reflection of the personality of the author or a reflection of the subject matter on which the writer is writing. And Lewis said it's the latter. It's what the book is about. Tilliard said it's a lot more about who the author is and his emotional state of mind. And they argued this. And I think Lewis pretty well established his position very firmly. I think you got to give Tilliard a little bit of credit, because we even do some of that, you and I probably, and some of our readers do some of that with Lewis. We commit what we call the personal heresy and say, this is what was going on in his life when he wrote this or that work. So the personal heresy, and then the Socratic Digest, which is another obscure kind of thing, but a collection of all of the talks that were given at the Oxford Socratic Club and published over the course of about 10 years, when Lewis was the president of that society before he took a position at Cambridge University. So that book is available at lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. And probably a few hundred copies of that book have been sold. So it's available on a print on demand option. But it's fairly technical. A lot of the talks at the Socratic Club were very, very philosophical. And so they're not especially within reach of the average reader, but there are 7 essays of Lewis that you can get in other places besides the Socratic Digest, but there are 7 essays of Lewis, most or all of which he first presented to the Oxford Socratic Club. And there are lots of talks that we have either no notes or some sketchy notes rather than the full text of what the speaker delivered at the Socratic Club.
Yeah, that book, just to let you in on a little secret, one day I couldn't find where I shuffled my copy, which bookshelf, upstairs, downstairs, in a box from moving. And so I just ordered another one. So I have 2 of those 100 copies. But yeah, not to discourage people from getting the current book we're talking about, No Ordinary People, but for listeners who have someone that's even a deeper Lewis fan than maybe yourself, if you're wanting to surprise them with something that they're not likely to have, then this Oxford Socratic Digest is something to get a hold of. And we'll have a link in the show notes, or at least there'll be a link to talk about that will have a link to it, so you can rabbit trail down that. But well, returning to your book, one can imagine that No Ordinary People took more than a little time to write. I already made reference to reading one of the chapters years ago, but tell us about the process overall and what was maybe the most enjoyable and the most challenging part of the journey to see it published.
I had the idea of doing something like this a long time ago, but my chronology was the starting point back in January of 2017 when I was teaching for a semester in Edmonton, Alberta. And that's when I started the chapter on Alec Vidler and decided there are a couple of other articles like this, such as an article on Warren Lewis that had been published elsewhere. And I started thinking, okay, could I pull together from things I'd previously written, and what could I add to this list? So the chronology for every chapter was the starting point, where I would look for a reference to, say, Austin Farrer, the Church of England theologian that lived in Oxford when Lewis did. And I'd look for his name in the chronology, and then I'd see the date where he was listed and what reason he was listed for, and look at any correspondence between Lewis and this individual. I would dig into the life history of each person that I was writing on with the help of obituaries, reminiscences by others, or by themselves. You know, I mentioned that Derek Brewer wrote a chapter in C.S. Lewis at the Breakfast Table, so you learn a little bit about Brewer by reading that chapter. I looked at the Dictionary of National Biography, which is a series of volumes in the United Kingdom all about famous people and some not so famous people of the past in the United Kingdom. And of course, not everybody in my book, No Ordinary People, is mentioned in the Dictionary of National Biography. But I also looked at the extensive resources of the Wade Center and other publications. Then I began to write and flesh out the article and print it and read it and edit it and look under every rock and corner that I could find. And I also asked several people to read and comment on some of the chapters, called on philosophers to read about people like Austin Farrer or Harry Weldon, who were philosophers, literary people to read articles about people like Muriel Bradbrook, who was a Shakespeare scholar, and people like Jerry Root. He had recommended the chapter on A.K. Hamilton Jenkin, an undergraduate friend of Lewis when they were both at Oxford University. So Jerry was willing to read and critique that chapter. And eventually you get to a point where, okay, it's time to start looking for a publisher. And I did, and I think I was blessed to benefit from Winged Lion Press and editor Bob Trexler, who I would say is the best editor I ever worked with.
Yeah, No Ordinary People, again, is the name of the book. And so we do encourage people to get a copy of it. Now, since we are recording this in mid to late February of 2022, and it came out near the end of last year, you had some, of course, endorsements, but also if people go to like Amazon or other places, they can see some reviews. I wondered if you could just summarize some of the responses to your book.
Well, I think probably Lou Marcus is the most enthusiastic supporter of what happens in this book. He's very interested in friendships and what friendships tell us about other people. And so he talks about that in his Amazon review. And we get to see some aspects of Lewis, such as his ability to maintain at least acquaintances, or if not friendships, with people that he was very... with whom he disagreed a great deal, like Alec Vidler or Arthur C. Clarke. So there are other people that have recommended the book, Angus Manoush, Steve Miller, Steve Beebe, and other people who've written in the area of Lewis studies. So they've read and critiqued some of the chapters. And the book is still getting out there, so there's more to happen yet in terms of these kinds of responses. But I think readers will enjoy reading each chapter, which, apart from the introductory chapter on friendship and what Lewis said about friendship, especially in The Four Loves, each chapter stands alone, so they don't have to be read in any particular order. And only the chapters that interest the person can be the chapters that they read.
Okay. Yeah. And then I'm thinking, down the road when someone might do a full life biography of Lewis, or maybe a mini series, and they want to, be able to have a good working knowledge of the friends that Lewis had, or people that he was still friends with, even though he disagreed with, then I think that film director will have to buy a copy of your book for everybody involved in the production. That's the kind of work that this is. It's got a good wide range in terms of, I was noting earlier, those who maybe are just interested in people's lives And maybe they know a little bit about Lewis, maybe they don't. They would still enjoy this. And then those who know a pretty good deal about Lewis would find this fascinating as well. So we do encourage people to consider getting a copy. And let's go ahead and wrap up here then by closing by having you give that final pitch. I sort of gave some of that, but as to, you know, why the reader should consider getting a copy of No Ordinary People.
Well, I think it's really a very unique book. You described it as biographical, and it is that very much so. But looking at Lewis through the eyes of people that he knew and some of them with whom he worked very closely. It's a book about friendship by a man who seems to have spoken or written well on virtually every subject he touched. With a country and a world so divided as we are now, we need resources to bring us together. If you lived in Lewis's day and he was your friend, you had a great friend indeed, or we might say you had one heck of a friend. In the chapters of this book, we meet lots of colorful characters who enrich our understanding of the life of C.S. Lewis and the biblical principles by which he lived. And so that would be my best recommendation for getting a copy of this book.
Well, great. And again, we do hope people will consider getting a copy. We'll have a link in the show notes where people can go ahead and get that. Again, No Ordinary People by Joel Heck. That is the book we've been talking about. Thanks, Joel, for being on All About Jack.
It's been a pleasure. A lot of fun to do with you, William.
Allow me to also thank you, the listener, for giving your attention to this episode of All About Jack, one of the many resources from the website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator and producer of this show. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series new for 2022 called Weekly Dose of C.S. Lewis Quotes. In addition to previous episodes of All About Jack on my website, you can find various articles about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. Also, consider checking out my YouTube channel, Knowing and Understanding C.S. Lewis. It also has a visual edition of the weekly quotes, as well as other content. There's a link in the show notes to it. Today, you heard an interview with Dr. Joel Heck. It was about the book No Ordinary People. You'll find a link in the show notes about getting a copy, along with any other related links mentioned during the show. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes, see the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.